Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Welcome to New Books in Film. I'm your host, Joel Cherney. Today, I'll be speaking with Robert Mattson, author of the book, Mission, Jimmy Stewart and the Fight for Europe, published in 2016 by Goodnight Books. While many fans of classic films know of Jimmy Stewart's movies, few are... Welcome to New Books in Film. I'm your host, Joel Cherney. Today, I'll be speaking with Robert Mattson, author of the book, Mission, Jimmy Stewart and the Fight for Europe, published in 2016 by Goodnight Books. While many fans of classic films know of Jimmy Stewart's movies, few are aware of what he contributed to the war effort. Mattson discusses Stewart's military background and how his World War II experiences affected his career. Welcome to Robert Mattson. Hey, Robert, it's great to talk to you.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Now, we know that many celebrities went into the service during World War II, but there haven't been, what I've seen, many books about their experiences and how they affected their lives. So your book I found to be incredibly moving for that purpose, plus all the information you provide. But let's talk about your background first. Before we did the recording, I was talking a little bit about doing a little bit of research, and you've certainly had an interesting career so far. So why don't you give me a little bit of background of what led you to becoming a writer?
Well, I didn't know what I wanted to be when I grew up. And coming out of college, I had my first book published by Bantam Books, and it was a book about how to do research because I had a history degree and I really liked doing research. So that was a mass market paperback in the last century sometime. And then this is my seventh book, the Stewart book. I found my niche, I think, in Hollywood books that actually have an aviation theme, which is quite the subgenre, but, my sixth book, which was really sort of a breakthrough, was called Fireball, and it was about the plane crash that killed Carol Lombard and 21 others near Las Vegas in 1942, right after the beginning of World War II. And I had one of the first media guys who interviewed me about that book said, "Are you a pilot? Because the aviation stuff rings so true." And I thought that was a great compliment, and no, I'm not a pilot, but I'm sort of an aviation buff, and I got a lot of grounding in that, working in NASA Aeronautics for 10 years, doing communications for NASA and being with really smart people in facing aeronautics challenges that are ongoing. And so I got to combine that interest with my love of Hollywood history, and the Carol Lombard book was very well received, and I was looking for another theme that would combine Hollywood history and aviation, and I was dumbfounded to realize that no one had really looked at Jimmy Stewart's World War II career as a combat pilot. There was one book that came out that was written by a colleague of his, a fellow officer in the 8th Air Force, but it was really superficial and it did not go into a mission by mission account. And so that was my starting point, was to see, can I find the records of each of his combat missions so that I can actually recreate them? And when I found out that I could, that was the jumping off point for me. And I set to work. And so in a nutshell, that's my entire career from my first mass market paperback, Research Made Easy in the Last Century, to my new book on Jimmy Stewart.
Well, if it means anything, I'm a history major as well. And work in a library, so I understand the research side quite well. So
yeah.
I understand that point. Have worked in libraries, public and academic, for my entire career, so I understand the joys of research. So yeah,
well, I've dealt with a lot of you people. Some of my best friends have been those who unearth information for me.
And you did actually, and this is something we'll talk about, you bring up some of the research and how you were able to do quite a bit of it. Yeah, I recently interviewed an author, Sue Matheson, who wrote a book about John Ford. And one of the points she made was how Ford changed after World War II and how you could see the difference with his work from before and after. And of course, that's one of your primary themes. Why Jimmy Stewart? I mean, obviously, you indicated that you were surprised that there were no detailed books on his career, career during World War II. But what was it about Jimmy Stewart in particular that made you decide to choose him?
I am not a Jimmy Stewart fan. I'm going to, on the book tour, I think that's going to be my lead on every lecture I give, is that I did not go into this a Jimmy Stewart fan. I'm not a fanboy. I didn't have this burning ambition to tell his story or whatever. I just thought, here is the most talked about World War II Hollywood combat figure. And what I went into this thinking was, is he the real deal, or was a lot of this, you know, PR generated? You know, was he a tin soldier like Clark Gable was to a large degree? And did, you know, what was his service really like? And so that's what started me doing the digging. Plus, we have some things in common, Stuart and I. We both grew up in small southwestern Pennsylvania college towns. He grew up in Indiana, PA. I grew up in California, PA.
No originality in Pennsylvania. You have to use other states for your town names.
You know, I always was embarrassed by the fact that my town was called California, Pennsylvania. So let's just not go there. But there's a mindset that goes with that, you know, that small town Pennsylvania coal country mindset that he had and that I have, and I was, you know, there's little kinship there, and so. While I wasn't a fan of his movies per se, I understood the guy going in a little bit, at least from that. Here's my cat again. The cat's on my lap. Cat's going down. I really can't give you a great answer as to why Stewart, except that I start out with a burning question, and the question this time was he a genuine hero or was he a manufactured hero? And 3 years later, I can give you a definitive answer. Or should I make you read the book?
No, that's fine. No. We can read the book. You're pretty clear right from the beginning, so that's okay. It's not a mystery story, basically.
Right, right. And yeah, he was the real deal. And there are so many layers to that, because he didn't want the spotlight. Once he entered the military, 1 month after he won the Best Actor Academy Award. And once he entered it, he didn't want to look back. He didn't want to talk to the press. He didn't want to do anything but be a soldier. And then he went overseas, and it was hard for him to get overseas because MGM, his home studio, didn't want him to go. And the U.S. government didn't want him to go, because what good could come of a Hollywood actor being shot down as a pilot over Europe and either killed or worse, captured by the Germans? So there was great reason to keep him stateside. He was much older than the other pilots in the Army Air Forces. Well, I mean, much older, like 10 years or more older. Which meant, you know, slower reflexes. Was he up to the physical demands of being a pilot? So against all those odds, he got himself overseas. He got himself in combat, and he flew 20 missions. and slowly came apart at the seams, as so many people did, because of the rigors of these missions. And so, you know, I have nothing but admiration for what the guy accomplished after all the research I did and the people I talked to.
Well, of course, now this is your second book now, dealing with people from that period, of course, given that Fireball, we're talking about the same, you know, actors from 40s and 50, you know, 30s, 40s, 50s in that period. I guess I'm wondering, is that a period of movies that you particularly enjoy, or is it just a matter that in this particular case you were able to find a lot of material dealing with Stewart, and so that helped make the decision for you as well?
No, I'm really a golden age Hollywood guy. I wrote two books before Fireball about Errol Flynn, you know, the swashbuckling actor. Mm-hmm. And the second of those was also about Olivia de Havilland.
She was still with us.
Yes, she is at 100 going strong.
Or at least in when we're doing this interview, sorry.
Yeah. So I just have had a burning interest since I was a teenager in old Hollywood. And so it's natural for me to live and breathe and walk around in that time frame and write about it and use their lingo and their technology. I'm perfectly comfortable there.
One of the things that this is something that I think gets forgotten in the old, you know, we're talking about a period of time, especially the World War II vets and during that period, you know, the group that have been dubbed the Greatest Generation. And one of the things that I think we tend to forget, or I think tends to get forgotten, is that when we talk about PTSD, for example, with Vietnam veterans and Iraq veterans and Afghan veterans, well, there's no way in the world you couldn't believe that the World War II veterans went through the same thing. The difference was when they came home, as you've pointed out with Stewart, they didn't want to talk about it, or they wouldn't talk about it.
Right. And that hasn't changed. You know, any war produces people who can't talk about it and see things that no one should see and face fears and either overcome them or worse, not overcome them. So Stewart came back suffering from, they called it being flak happy, if you were a flyer and had flown too many missions, or they call it combat fatigue, or they call it shell shock. Mm-hmm. But whatever it was, he suffered it like everybody else just because of having, you know, not only are you flying into a hail of bullets or anti-aircraft fire, but you're also facing the strain, in his case, of leading other men and making decisions that affect their lives, because he was a flight commander. He was older and he had good leadership skills. So he was in the front of his squadron or his group, and he was making the calls in the air. He was like the quarterback. And he was guiding the other flyers on the mission. And some of those guys got shot down. Some of the guys in his squadron were killed. And he had to face that guilt because he was a perfectionist. He had to face that guilt for the rest of his life. What did I do? What could I have done differently that would have saved this guy's life or that guy's life? These guys that I had trained with and knew and led in combat. So that's one of the things that he faced when he came home, too, the fact that he came home and some of his guys didn't.
So the first part of the book, well, you do a real brief introduction at the beginning of him after the war, you know, working on a film specifically. We'll talk about the film later, because right. It is, I think, quite apt that the film, first film he made after he came out of the war, was It's a Wonderful Life. But before that, though, the much of the early part of the book is basically a biography of Stewart's early life. And one of the things you talk about is the importance of the service, the military service, to his family. What were some of the things that he had going on in his mind that as far as what might be expected of him as from a family of servicemen?
Well, his family service went all the way back to the American Revolution. And both of his grandfathers had served in the Civil War, and one of them died right before he was born, and the other one, who had fought under Custer and Sheridan in the Shenandoah Valley in some really tough battles, lived until Jim was well into his 20s, like 25 years old. And so Jim grew up like literally on the knee of a man who had lived history and fought battles and would tell his grandson what it was like to, you know, what it was like to be with Custer, riding with Custer, for crying out loud. You know, how can you even imagine something like that? So he had a lot to live up to. And his father had gone off adventuring to the Spanish-American War. And that was a very short lived experience. And, you know, that wasn't much of a war as wars go. And I don't think he saw any service. I think he was in harm's way for like 3 days or something. And so his father, Alex, had this burning ambition to serve like his father had. And so when World War I came along, he became a captain of ordnance and went off to serve in the lowlands. And he did, he didn't get to the front lines, but he was near enough to the front lines in this horrific war to come back a battle-scarred veteran. And so Jim had the pressure of two grandfathers who were like heroes, you know, and a father who had been a captain in the army and seen action. And Alex was a tough guy. I mean, tough, kind of crazy, kind of a crazy guy. I'm glad he wasn't my dad, but he really pushed service on his son. You know, you must do this. And so, you know, it was Jim's mindset from he is a little kid. His father goes off to war when he's like 9, and his mother's making him uniform so he can be just like his dad. And he's having plays in his basement about, you know, the war, and he's using artifacts sent back from his dad, like German trench helmets, in his plays about how bad the Huns are. And so it was always in his head. It was always there. I've got to go and fight in a war. And you know, from 1932 on, when Hitler started to rise to power, everybody seemed to know that sooner or later there was going to be a war. And he started to get ready for it.
Because, as you point out, the parallel of not only all of this, you know, the military part, but then also his burgeoning career as an actor, as you point out, that is his first experiences as an actor was in his basement doing war plays. But he went from there, and while all of this was going, you know, the military part was in the background, so to speak, he was also starting what turned out to be pre-war, a pretty successful career.
Yeah, and he sort of backed into it because he didn't know what he wanted to be when he grew up either. He studied several different things, and the last was to be an architect at Princeton. And he graduated with a degree in that, but he didn't really have any urge to do that. And much to his father's chagrin, he started this acting business, you know, as an activity at school, and really liked it and became friends with other actors. And it was like horrific. It was horrible for Alex to see his son, you know, become this, you know, nomad, going around in plays and touring the country in plays and then going to Hollywood and really not having a real job, because Alex ran a hardware business in coal country. So that was a real job. But Jim was of a completely different mindset, always a conservative sort of a guy in some ways, but still a liberal in other ways, like just being an actor, you know. That's a much different way to be. And so he ended up in Hollywood with his best friend, Henry Fonda, who had also come from New York to Hollywood. And both of them just had this meteoric rise to stardom against all odds, because here are these two string beans, you know, 6'3", 6'4", both extremely underweight, both introverted, very quiet sort of guys, and they become Hollywood stars. It's crazy, but that's what happened.
Yeah, because one of the things that you, one of the places you go early on is discuss who some of the folks that he knew, you know, he met early on, and how it's unbelievable when you think about it that a group of people that all became so well known and so famous for good reason. They all had good, they all had great talent. But I mean, even people like, you know, Burgess Meredith, and every time I was reading a page and I says, wow, I didn't know that they were all in the, you know, they all had a certain amount of similarities as far as how they came through and that they actually knew each other and roommating at some times. And it's just unbelievable to see how all of those folks during that period interrelated to each other.
Yeah. Like Burgess Meredith, of course, played the Penguin in Batman. You know, I don't know if that's how people know him or not, but he had a long and distinguished career.
They probably know him more from Rocky now than that.
Well, that's true. That's right. That's right. Because I wasn't a big Rocky fan, but yes, he was. He was in that. And Fonda, of course, had a tremendous career. He didn't make as many pictures as you'd think he made, but he made a lot of pictures, and he remained friends with Stewart throughout the course of their lives, to the very end for Fonda when he died of cancer. And what was I going to say? I just lost it.
Okay.
So let's go on.
And then, of course, the early stories that you have about Margaret Sullivan as well during this period.
Yeah. She was quite the pistol, and Fonda married her, and then Stewart became terribly infatuated with her. The Fonda marriage didn't last but a few months, really. She was a wild sort of a girl, and Stewart, it was the biggest mismatch ever. I mean, there was really no reason why Stewart would want someone who was flamboyant and outgoing and everything that she was, and flighty and narcissistic. But he really fell for her. He was young, and she was very vivacious, and that was the first love of his life. And it's so odd that, you know, he never married her. She kept marrying his best friends, Leland Hayworth, the Hollywood agent and theatrical producer. She married him after she married Fonda, and Stewart remained very close to this woman that he couldn't have. Although there was talk that, you know, before she married Hayward, that they had had a physical affair, which I believe. I think he was very sexual, as maybe we'll talk about. But it ended up that he wasn't with her, but he always carried a torch for her.
Of course, the other thing that you talk about early on, particularly when he was young, and this had it actually worked out for him, that he grew up. His growing came at the same time that the airplane grew, and he grew right along with that. What were some of his early experiences with flying?
Well, as you recall, I start some of my chapters with, you know, Jimmy Stewart had to fly, and you know, some people are born to fly, and he was one of those guys, and he realized it as early as during World War I. The Great War, as they called it then. So he's 9 years old, and he's captivated by pictures of airplanes. You know, he talked about having magazine covers of that showed airplanes in the context of World War I, and how he would put them on his wall, and he would build model planes. And before he ever went up in a plane, he was just fixated on aviation and on airplanes. And so he hatched a scheme to actually go up in an airplane, and he achieved that when some of these World War I flyers would go around barnstorming, and they would earn their living by taking people up for rides in their planes. And so a plane came to Indiana, PA, and Jim talked his father into letting him go up. And that wasn't easy, because Alex wanted no part of that. And in fact, when Jim did talk him into it and save up enough money from working at the hardware store to go up in a plane, Alex brought a doctor along in case the plane crashed. And it didn't. And Jim went up four or five times with barnstorming pilots over the next few years, and he was hooked. And he was going to be a pilot one way or another. And it took him all the way until he was in Hollywood in 1935. And the first thing he did when he had enough money and had signed a studio contract was to take flying lessons. And before long, he had bought his own airplane. And for the next, you know, well into the 1980s, he continued to fly. So that's 50 years in the air.
So before we start talking about the specifics of most of the book, which is stories, basically, of his career in the military, and I'm going to call it a career, even though it wasn't his real career. He certainly lived a life in the military that counted as a career. What kind of information or what kind of research did you have to do to pull together so much varied information that you were able to get so much details about his life in the military?
Well, as I said, I started with the U.S. Army Air Force's records. And it's not like I went and sifted through all those myself. Any smart project leader is going to delegate. And I had a researcher on the ground in D.C. She knows all the ins and outs. She knows every cubbyhole. And she found, in short order, the records of the U.S. Army Air Forces. And I gave her a list of the missions and his squadron and his bomb group, and she found everything for me. That was a starting point. Another government facility has his complete personnel file. It's like 500 pages, and I got that. And so armed with those two things, I could create an outline of his step-by-step progress from induction in Los Angeles to mustering out in New York City, and the 4 full years in between. Then there are, of course, existing books and magazine articles and diaries from people who flew with him, quite a number of them. And then what I didn't expect to find was people still living who flew with him during the war. And that was the most exciting part, is like to talk to, I found three guys, almost four, but I found three guys who actually flew with him. Two were co-pilots in his squadron and so had done a lot of flying with him, some of them on missions. And they really gave me the inside story on not only what was he like, what was Stuart like as a combat officer and as a leader, but what was the war like? What was a B-24 like? And that was another thing that I did, which was, how can you write a book about World War II bombers without flying in World War II bombers? So I went up in a B-17 and a B-24 and sat with the pilot and co-pilot and crawled down into the bomb bay and crawled into the front compartment where the bombardier and the navigator sat and went back into the tail turret. And, I mean, so there, it's a 360-degree experience to create something like this that's going to be authentic. And it's talking to people and it's going, oh, and that's another thing. It was, I had to go to England to the little village in East Anglia where his base was during the toughest combat missions. And I did that and I walked that ground and I went into his quarters there against all odds are still standing. And to go in there and to feel the damp cold, just like he felt it, you know, after all of that, I had what I needed to write what I thought was an authentic account of his wartime experience.
So basically, we've got the story of Stuart. We've got the story of Stuart as a military man, and then also the story, to an extent, of aviation in World War II. And it's an interesting, I think sometimes we think of World War II, you know, we get the stories of that. And of course, things like ground troops are well known, but it is interesting how much the air part of the war, how important the air war was to World War II.
Yeah, I didn't realize, people don't realize in general that until D-Day, the war in Europe was entirely an air war. The fight for France and the fight in Germany was entirely an air war. And it was the U.S. Army Air Forces bombing by day and the British, the RAF, bombing by night. The U.S. Army Air Forces bombing strategic targets and trying to avoid hitting civilians, the RAF bombing by night and not caring who the hell they hit. The more civilians they killed, the better, as far as the Brits were concerned, because, Hitler had sent the Luftwaffe to bomb England. That's what started the war, really. That's what started the war for Britain, was the battle for Britain. And so much infrastructure had been damaged, so many people had been killed, and the killing had been indiscriminate, that the RAF wanted to take that right back to Germany and give it back to them. But the U.S. had a completely different mindset, and so they were bombing by day, and they were doing it to hit the military targets that were going to bring the war to an end, and they were going to do it at a tremendous price, because they were... They were bombing in broad daylight in these giant lumbering, it's like taking a train in the air at 20,000 feet. It's just this biggest, easiest to hit target in the world. And yet here are these young guys going over and doing just that. And that was the really brutal war that America was fighting in the air over Europe in 1943 and 1944.
So how closely was Stuart following what was going on in Europe in the 30s? You mentioned it briefly before, but was it something that was on his radar? No pun intended. I mean, was this something that he knew? You mentioned he knew, or it seemed like he knew he was the belief was the United States was eventually, or there was eventually going to be a war. Obviously, 32, 33, it was still far off. But was Stuart paying attention during this period? I mean, was he expecting himself that things were going to get worse?
America was an isolationist country in through the 30s and even into the early 40s. People did not want to get into a war, and it was being avoided as much as possible. And still, Stuart had the mindset. He had his father's mindset. He had his grandfather's mindset. And he was a very aware person. He was a very smart guy. And he, when he bought his airplane, he bought a Stinson that was the kind of airplane that the Army pilots were training on. And I'm talking about in 1937. We're talking about regular Army, peacetime Army pilots were training in Stinson. So that's why he bought a Stinson. And that's why he logged hours, and he logged acrobatic hours, because that was going to be important to be a combat pilot. And, he takeoffs and landings and navigation and flying by instruments. I mean, he did all of that because he knew what was coming. And that's as of 1936, 1937, 1938. So yes, I mean, it was very much on his radar, no pun intended, that a war was coming and that he needed to keep abreast of it. He also went to Europe. A lot of people don't know this, but in 1939, he went to Europe, and there's really no documentation on what he did there, but I just get the feeling he was getting the lay of the land because he knew what was coming.
So the war, obviously Pearl Harbor, December 7th, that's when the United States is officially in World War II. Obviously, the initial port was against Japan, but very quickly Germany declared war on the United States, and so therefore the United States was now fighting both countries. But the European war was on for the United States. What did Stuart do during this period, and how quickly did he decide it was time to go?
Well, let's see. Yeah, December 7, 1941 was Pearl Harbor. He was already in the military for 9 months. There was, because it was so clear by the beginning of 1941, actually, it was so clear in 1940 that war was coming, that they instituted a draft. And you know, the pool is however many million men, and Stuart's draft number was number 300, and he called it winning the lottery. And so he got to go in the service. And imagine Louis B. Mayer, the head of MGM, finding out that one of my most profitable actors wants to go in the military, and that wasn't going to fly, but it did. I mean, he gleefully tried to go enter the service and was turned down because he was underweight, because he was, imagine this. I mean, here he is, he's 6'3", he's either 6'3" or 6'4", and accounts vary, but he was at least 6'3" and he weighed 140 pounds. And there's no way that's going to look healthy. And so he got turned down, and he carefully schemed his way. He had to get around that. He had to serve. He had to go into service. And so he went to military doctors, and he had them draft a letter that says, this guy is healthy. It's just his body type is just very thin. And he got that in writing. I have that document. It was in his personnel file for, you know, all these years. And he used that thing. He wielded that letter, and he got himself inducted in March of 1941, 9 months before Pearl Harbor. And so he was already a corporal by the time the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor in December. And what did they do? They did it by air. And he knew that this was going to be an air war and how important aviation was going to be. And he was going to be in the thick of it because he was going to be a pilot.
It sounds like they could have taken his attempt to get into the military and used it for the opening of Captain America. Same concept. He gets,
oh yeah,
keeps getting refused, but finds a way to get in anyway. Mm-hmm. Of course, probably by the time the war actually started, it probably wouldn't have been as difficult to get in, as it turns out. Was he flying right at the beginning, early on in his military career, or did that come later?
He had to earn his wings. You know, he started out training, doing his own training, and then he became a trainer. When he became a corporal, he was drilling other troops. He was stuck on the ground, though, until he earned his wings, and that was at the turn of 1942, he became a second lieutenant. He had logged the necessary hours, and then he took his flight test. And that was a very specific thing where you had to do all these, you know, aerial maneuvers and take off and land and do very specific things. And of course, he aced that because he had spent so many years preparing for this moment. And so then he was a second lieutenant and quickly became an instructor, because he was, at this time, 35, 36 years old. All the pilots coming in were 20. So here he is, this older guy. He becomes a flight instructor in single-engine aircraft, then twin-engine aircraft, then four-engine heavy bombers, works as when he becomes a four-engine-rated pilot, he becomes a captain. And so he's on this tremendous track to stay stateside and stay safe and just train all these guys who would go off and fight. And that just did not sit well with him at all. And he would not take that for his military career. And so he was a pilot pretty early on, to answer your question. And then he took it from there.
When was his actual first mission?
When he finally got the backing of some key officers who were full colonels, lieutenant colonels, full colonels. To get him overseas, and I still don't quite know how they accomplished it. I mean, I don't know how they stuck their necks out that far, first of all, and how they got permission for Stuart to go. But Stuart went overseas in November of 43, and he flew his first mission on December 13th, 1943, at a time when it was still really dicey to go across the Channel or go across the North Sea and bomb Germany, because the German defensive forces were very capable, and it got it got less dangerous as the months went on, but the initial missions were quite harrowing, and in German winter too. And that was another, that's another thing that just blew me away. That I don't know if your questions are going to go there anyway, but it's 20,000 feet in an unpressurized cabin in European winter. So it's at a minimum of 30 below zero at 20,000 feet, and in with the air coming straight through the fuselage, because you've got gun ports that aren't covered. And so imagine what that's like. And the missions are 7 or 8 hours in length. So you do the math on that. These guys, I don't want to call them the greatest generation. I have my own theories about that, but I will say that these were tough guys, and they did incredible things.
So, obviously, so we're saying, really, then what's even more unbelievable, you talked about the number of missions he went on. It was in a very compressed period of time. If his first mission was the end of 1943, that means he had to have done all of his missions in less than 2 years.
Yeah, and really, he did his first dozen missions in his first 3 months of flying, and those were the ones that marked him and scarred him the worst, because they were some of the toughest that you can imagine. There was a mission, his worst, one of his toughest missions was to Gotha, and on during this concentrated effort to hit the German aviation industry. It was called Big Week, and it was February 1944. On February 24th, 1944, his bomb group was decimated in a raid over Gotha. And you read the book, so you know what the official description was of what that battle was like, that aerial battle with planes blowing apart and flyers coming out of their own ships without parachutes and banging into the windscreens of the ships below. And I mean, it was just hell on earth. And he wasn't on that mission, but he watched the planes limp home that made it back. And then he had to fly the next day. And he talked about, one of the rare things he ever talked about his military career was that night, and what it was like knowing he had to go back to Gotha the next day after what had happened to so many of the guys that he knew and the flyers he had flown with, and how many planes didn't come back, and what it was like to get in the air the next day and go back and bomb the same place again. Too many experiences like that for him. And just imagine that is the guy you see in It's a Wonderful Life. That is the guy. That's what's locked up in his head, is everything that he had been through, things like Gotha and other missions like that.
So I think you said 20 missions, but that number, what does that mean? I mean, I know we talk about 20. I mean, how is that as far as in comparison? I mean, obviously, the point is clear that that was a large number of missions. But to give us a scope, what does that mean to have flown 20 missions during World War II?
Well, I talked to the two co-pilots that I mentioned that I talked to that had flown with Stuart. So Stuart flew his first mission on December 13th, 1943. One of the guys I talked to flew a couple of missions and was shot down on December 29th of 43. So he was shot down 16 days after Stuart flew his first mission, which was the first mission of that whole bomb group. This guy was shot down 16 days later. The other guy, who was co-pilot, was shot down 7 days past that. So, I mean, surviving to 20 missions was very much against the odds at this time in the war, because, you know, you've got the best air force in the world trying to shoot you down and the best gunners on the ground trying to shoot you down. Plus you're in the B-24 Liberator, which was maybe the most dangerous plane for the guys flying it in World War II. It was a flying bomb. And that was one thing that I didn't know until I talked to the guys who had ridden in it and operated it, that it had fuel leak problems, and they were systemic problems, and they fixed it. They would fix it sort of with every new version of the B-24 that came along, but these were the B-24Hs they were flying, and they were still very dangerous. One spark and boom, you're gone. You know, you're gone. The plane is gone. There's no trace ever found of you because the plane has blown into a million pieces. And that happened to one of his pilots. There is no way to tell what happened to Earl Metcalf and his crew, because their B-24 just vanished because it blew up in the air. And so making it to 20 missions was against the odds. And he had a couple of near misses, Stuart did, where there is no reason he should have lived. But he did make it to 20 missions, and it was quite an accomplishment.
So let's obviously, most of the book, just, you know, is a review after the biography, you know, once getting into the military and into the war itself. And then, of course, most of the book are stories about these various missions and some of his other experiences. Obviously, that's most of the book, which it's just the good thing is the amount of detail you were able to find made it possible to create some incredible pictures of what it must have been like. What was daily life like for him during this period around the missions?
Well, when he was a squadron leader, he was a captain of the 703rd Squadron in the 445th Bomb Group. He was always involved with either training his men or preparing them for missions or debriefing them afterwards, and that would be daily. When he moved up to become the operations officer of the 453rd Bomb Group, which was a group that wasn't exactly in trouble, but it was a fatigued group that was just up the road from his base. And he went there to try to try to instill some of the precision flying in that group that he had instilled in the 445th. And so as an operations officer, he was doing a lot more of the preparing the crews and briefing the missions and briefing the crews that would go off, and he was doing less flying. And so he became more of a staff-type officer and more of a desk-type officer the farther he went into the war, until the point where he was flying very little because of the stress. At the beginning, he was flying every few days, and before too long, I mean in the course of months, he was flying maybe twice a month. He would miss rotations because of the cumulative effect at his age, and I'm doing air quotes, his age of 36 and 37 years old, being so much older, the missions being so grueling, that he actually flew less and less and was involved in briefing crews and all of the logistical things on the ground more and more.
Now, I know it really isn't so much part of the book, but I have to ask, the people that he worked with and led and part of his group, did he continue to have contact with them after the war?
You would think that the answer would be yes, but it was from a distance because he was a very private person. And as much as he loved these guys and loved the shared experience of going through the war with them and called it the most vivid time of his life and the most important time of his life and the best time of his life, as much as he said all that, being the private person that he was and being the star that he was, he kept his distance. And it made the guys that I talked to, feel bad. I mean, it did, because they loved him, and they were proud that they flew with him, and they would have been so happy if he had come to their weddings or if he, you know, they would invite him places, but he just wouldn't do it. It just wasn't his style. He did keep his distance, and, well, I understand. I'm an introvert. I keep my distance.
It's interesting, the concept of a Hollywood star being an introvert, but believe it or not, you know, from the readings I've done and the people I've interviewed over doing these interviews, especially during most of the people I've interviewed, probably are a lot of the biographical ones have been for this period. you know, 30s, 40s, 50s. And introversion is not that surprise. You know, it's normal, even though it may seem surprising that, that somebody who's an actor and a famous one at that could be considered an introvert.
Yeah. And it, see, he performed. He was a performer. He liked being other people. He didn't really like being him as much as he liked being other people. And he also had a very short attention span, and he was easily bored. And that's something that people don't think about with Jimmy Stewart, but it's true. He would get bored, which is why he could never be an architect, but he could play a different guy, a different person, you know, every 6 or 8 weeks, then take some time off and then play another person for 6 or 8 weeks. It's perfect for a person with a short attention span or a person who's easily bored. And that was another facet to his character.
So the book obviously emphasizes the actual war period, but I don't want to get away from what in the end was, how did the war affect his career? You don't go into a lot of detail because that's not part of the story, so to speak, but you obviously talk about the film that, and we mentioned earlier, that came out, that hit this first film after the war, which of course was It's a Wonderful Life, which he made with Frank Capra, who of course also had his own wartime experiences.
Right.
What were those? I mean, how did that come about? Was it a matter that it just happened to be the first film afterwards, or was it something that came out special because of, for a variety of reasons, that he was the one who was going to be in that film? I know he and Capra already had a relationship. But what led to It's a Wonderful Life?
Well, Stewart came back from the war having aged tremendously. I have a side-by-side photos in the book of Stewart in 1942 and Stewart in 1944. And the one is this young guy, you know, with rosy cheeks and looking great. And the next is this haggard old man, which was him at his worst after, you know, flying too many missions in too short a time. And he came back, and like people like his parents took one look at him. They hadn't seen him for a couple, 2.5 years. They hadn't seen him. And, oh, my God, this is my son? And Henry Fonda looked at him and said, oh, my God, you know, who is this guy? Because he had aged so badly. And all of a sudden, he wasn't going to be able to play, you know, the vibrant young leading man that he had been playing, the boy next door. He wasn't the boy next door. He was the troubled man next door. And so he didn't know. Plus, he came back to a Hollywood where there were new leading men. You know, there was Dana Andrews had come along, and Cornell Wilde, and George Montgomery, and Burt Lancaster was just about to make it big, and so was Kirk Douglas. And these guys had all filled in the spots of the men who had gone off to fight the war. And so Stewart didn't know, you know, where he fit, because he was no longer young. He was only, what was he? He was only 37 or 38, but he felt older and he looked older. And he didn't get any offers when he came back. The only offer that he had was Louis B. Mayer, his old boss, wanting to make the Jimmy Stewart story about his time in service. And he refused. He decided right away when he came back and hit U.S. shores, he was never going to use his service to promote his film career. And he had it written into every contract thereafter that you must not talk about my service when you do flack publicity for my picture. So he had no job offers. And it was 4 or 5 months. Okay, stand by. Stand by. My wife is coming in. I'm still on this interview, okay? Okay. All right.
My wife's walked in on mine, too, on my end, too, so I understand.
Oh, there you are. Okay, so I'm just going to wait till she sets down the Chinese that's going to be our dinner. Okay, that's done. All right, so...
We were talking about how It's a Wonderful Life came along.
Right. So he is sitting around Hollywood. He is back from the war. Henry Fonda is back from the war. Fonda served in the Pacific. Stewart served in Europe. Fonda was in the Navy. Stewart was in the Air Forces. And they had sort of the time of their lives because neither – they both had to just sort of get back into the Hollywood culture that they had been away from for years, and Hollywood had to get used to them again, having them around. So they listened to records, they made model airplanes, they flew kites. You know, they started to date around, or Stewart did. Fonda was married. Fonda's wife was sick to death of having Stewart around the house because Stewart came back to Hollywood having nowhere to live. And Fonda said, hey, come stay with us. No problem. My wife doesn't mind. Well, she minded. And she wanted to get rid of Stewart in the worst way. And finally, Frank Capra, who was back from the war, as you said, called Stewart and said, you know, I have an idea for a picture. It's kind of crazy. Do you want to talk about it? And Stewart was like, sure, because Stewart saw Capra as the gold standard of Hollywood directors, and they had had a lot of success together. And so they sat down over dinner, and Stewart's new agent was there, and Capra tried to tell this story of a guy who wants to commit suicide, but there's an angel who needs to earn his wings, who tries to keep the guy from committing suicide. And he tells this story, and Stewart had made Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, you know, a real blood and guts sort of a political picture, a very grounded in reality sort of. And here's Capra talking about angels, and Stewart didn't take it well, and he walked away that night he was not pleased, and his new agent wasn't pleased. And so it took a while of not having any offers and of thinking of this crazy story, and for Capra to call back and say, I don't think I told that well. Can we try again?
It's bad when a storyteller can't tell a story.
Yeah, but it was, you know, it was so off the wall. And so Stewart said, okay, you know, and basically the way he told the story years and years afterwards was, you know, if you want to make a picture about a guy committing suicide and an angel saving the day, I'm your man. And so that's how he was signed to do It's a Wonderful Life, a picture that he really didn't know if it would succeed or not. His only offer at the time. And here he is, a guy with the shakes who was just starting to put weight back on from being in the war. And that's where I start and end the book, because it's, to me, it's the greatest story in the world, that of all pictures, this is the one he comes back to. And this is what's going on in his head while he's making it, which you don't see, you know. And the fact that when it was released, it wasn't a giant hit.
No.
It did pretty well. It had a tremendous negative cost. It would cost a lot to produce this picture. All Capra pictures were expensive because he, you know, he threw in the kitchen sink. And so it couldn't possibly make money. It did all right. You know, it almost broke even. There's a legend that it was a bomb, but it wasn't. I mean, it did well, but it was so expensive to produce that it took until television that it really became the beloved classic that it is today. But what an interesting story, you know. What a wonderful story of how he came back from the war and made this picture.
Well, and you think about the story itself and say, okay, here's this man who didn't even make it to the war. I mean, the movie takes place during the war, or, you know, the lion's share of the movie, the major part of the movie is still during the war, and yet he plays a character who, because of his health, his ears in this case, couldn't even go to the war. And knowing what you've put in this book and in the background that I suspect most people probably didn't have no way of knowing, I suspect it's going to make the viewing of the film even more interesting, given what was going on in his mind at the time, as you pointed out.
Hey, I hadn't thought of that. You just gave me goosebumps. But yeah, that's pretty cool to think about, that maybe it will instruct people on what they're seeing. You know, maybe it'll give people a little more appreciation of this guy that they're looking at.
Yeah, unfortunately, the film only gets, in these days, it's a Christmas movie. That's the way it gets portrayed. And it's really not a Christmas movie, except the fact that the end of it takes place, you know, it's framed around Christmas, but I don't consider that to be the important aspect of it. I think instead it's given the time period, and probably there were a number of post-World War II films that dealt with the issues of returning soldiers, where this time the movie didn't deal with returning soldiers, but the actor happened to be a returning soldier.
Yeah. And it's funny that, you know, in this story, his brother is the one who's the hero. George has to stay home, and his brother only gets to be a hero because George saved his life, saved Harry's life. I don't know. There's so much irony here. It's great.
So obviously this book, you know, is spent a lot of, you know, you said 3 years at least dealing with the research and the writing. Do you know what's next? I mean, do you have the next thing on your mind as to where you're going to go from here? Obviously, between Fireball and now this book, you've got two very great books about a period, generally the same period of time, even though completely different topics. But do you have something in mind for next?
I do. I wish I could talk about it, but I can't because
I get that regularly. Don't worry about it.
It's a terrific idea. I don't know if I can pull it off. You know, I had talked about how I didn't know if I could pull Stuart off, and I had to have this core research. Was it there? Yes, it's there. Okay, this mission is a go. Well, I have that again, but I have to actually go to Europe, go back to Europe to archives and find out if the information is there for my next book. And if it is, then we will be back here in about 4 years, and you won't believe what you just read.
Well, I've got to say this about this book. There's so many different layers to it to me, but probably to me as a historian, librarian, I think the ability that you showed that even today you can create a story about something that at original thought, as you pointed out right at the beginning when you were considering it, is can I even tell this story? And yet you proved it could be told. And I just hope that other, besides readers, I hope other writers look at at what you were able to do and say, okay, there are other stories out there to tell, not just about individuals, but I mean, you know, just periods of time and the whole issues of what it was like for the, you know, we know the normal person, well, remember, celebrities are still normal people, and seeing how the war affected them in the same way as everyone else. And so that's why one of the things I was really impressed with is that you showed what kind of research you could still do on a topic and come up with something so involved and so it presents such a great story.
Well, thank you. That's a very high compliment. And the thing that, you know, as a person who has an affinity for history, what always bothered me, and I mean really bothered me and still does, is how any writer could manage to make history boring. You know, because history was people living dangerous lives, living interesting lives, people overcoming fear, people being brave, people being cowards, whatever. How could you make that anything but fascinating and involving and exciting? And so that's the way I try to approach anything I write is like, you know, just let the story happen and take the reader with you. And let's have an adventure together. That's the way I always look at it.
Well, hopefully, I know we're recording this. Even the book isn't even scheduled to come out yet for basically a couple months still, based on when we're recording. But I hope it does as well as your last one. I hope it does better, obviously. I really appreciate the fact that you were willing to talk about it in such detail. As I say, there's a lot there, and I just, not only do I hope people reach out for the book, obviously, but I think hopefully they'll go back and look at some of his post-World War II films, starting with It's a Wonderful Life, and just to remind themselves that he was an example of a changed man because of the war, and we can actually see it on the screen.
And just when you look at his pictures, in so many of his pictures after the war, there will be blind rage, starting in It's a Wonderful Life when he rips up his living room. In Winchester 73, he almost kills Dan Duryea. You know, over and over again, there are these blind rages that he let himself access and that he wanted those things in his pictures because he could now understand rage. He could now let it out. It was always with him, and it was because of the war.
Thank you for talking to me. This was a great discussion, and I hope the book does very well. It should. It deserves it. Thanks a lot, Robert.
Thank you, Joel. I really appreciate it.
I hope you enjoyed my talk with Robert. Like me, I think you will look at It's a Wonderful Life differently, thinking of what Stuart had just experienced. This is Joel Cherney, and I will be back soon with more New Books in Film.